The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi guys, we want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. Our guest today is, well, he's a very nice fellow. We've known him for a long time.
He's a nice boy. We found him on the street.
His name is Don Hahn. And it's tough to summarize what Don is. But to me, Don, you are living Disney studio history. That's what you are. That's what you embody.
Wow, thanks. I'm happy to be that.
Right? Well, there's nothing you haven't done there.
You were just saying you played with the remnants of the Firehouse 5 Plus 2. That is not...
Yeah, it's great. Well, there's always been a studio band for a long, long time. But when I started, I was a drummer. And so I sat in and Frank Thomas was still playing piano. And Ozzie Nelson's brother Don was playing alto sax. And, it was that kind of thing. But it was a very small collegial studio back then. This is
I
know. I'm lucky.
It's so cool.
And we're going to go through all that. I mean, your headline is that you are the producer of Beauty and the Beast and The Lion King, as many others
the
as well.
The not remake, live action, whatever they are, the real...
You know, he's done some live action interpretations
as
well.
In particular.
But I mean, if you grew up seeing, loving Beauty and the Beast and or The Lion King, mm-hmm. the headline attraction is... This guy produced those movies.
It's true. Yeah. I was the first guy on Beauty and the Beast. We had just finished Roger Rabbit, actually, in London with Richard Williams, amazing animator. And I get this phone call saying, hey, we'd like to do Beauty and the Beast. Walt tried it. We never quite pulled it together.
Walt couldn't do it. You want to try?
Yeah. So no pressure there. Yeah. and it was, it was tough. It was a mess. We went through a lot of hoops to try to get that movie up. And it finally came together thanks to a lot of special people.
Yeah.
And it has the distinction of being the first animated feature to be nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
Yeah, Walt, won that Oscar for Snow White after it came out, with the large Oscar statue and the seven small ones.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an honorary, gee, aren't you great, but you're not really part of the big leagues. And I think we always felt like animation was at the kids' table in the kitchen, which was not a bad place, really.
I think a dwarf Academy Award would have that effect on a person.
It would make you feel
that
way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got a real grown-up nomination, which was extraordinary because that just didn't happen.
No.
I don't think people looked at animation as part of the movie business. It was a kids' medium, and to be able to cut through that was pretty astounding. And then you look at animation today, which is exploded and is in every movie, including live-action movies, and it's pretty astounding.
Well, it's because of Beauty and the Beast they created the Best Animated Feature category.
Yeah, it's true. And there's been very few animated films that have gotten into the Best Picture category because of that animated film category. And, it's good. It's good that the Academy's kind of recognize animated shorts, animated features, but it really did bust up the categories and create that new space. And it created some new music categories, too, because every year Alan Menken was walking away with Oscars.
That's right.
Now, am I remembering correctly, is that the one you showed as a work in progress?
We did,
At Lincoln Center at the New York Film Festival?
That's right. Yeah, the New York Film Festival, Lincoln Center, packed house. Talk about flop sweat. So we went out on stage, and we'd never done this before, but one of the marketing guys had this idea. And in the end, it was a brilliant idea because people at that time didn't know animation. And so part of the education of people around that time was to show them artwork. So we did a show at the Whitney Museum in New York. We did this kind of unfinished screening. And it was terrifying. And yet at the end of the very first number bell, people broke into applause like it was a live Broadway show. And then we thought, okay, this is going to be okay. And then they did, after every number, they started applauding. And at the end of 90 minutes, we went up to join, to sit in one of the boxes on the side and just watch the audience, just thinking everybody would applaud and leave. Everybody stands up and starts applauding, and they turn to the box. And in the box is Roy Disney and Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale, the directors, and me. I felt like, you know, Imelda Marcos or something like that. Eva Perón.
Just arms up.
We did wave gently.
I thank you.
But the reaction was, you don't get into animation to have a reaction like that. You don't get into animation to tour and travel and do film festivals. You're in animation because you're introverted and like to draw in your notebook, you know, and that's what we were.
So it's well, and there's a lot more to discuss around that.
So many.
But we want to turn the clock back a little bit, maybe more than a little bit, and ask you how you got into all of this in the first place.
Oh, man. Well, grew up in Southern California, loving Disneyland and loving the Sunday Night Disney Show. Really, I never really thought of working there. I thought, oh, I wasn't even aware that people could work there. I went to music school. I was an art minor and a music major, which in retrospect makes some sense about animation. And I got a summer job working in the morgue, which sounds like the place where Walt Disney's frozen, but it's not.
Hey!
Do we have to have room shots ready?
Because yes.
We'll do, but you can do that in post. It's
all right,
okay.
Fine.
So I got this job in the morgue, which is in the basement of the old Ink and Paint building on the Disney studio lot in Burbank, working for this really great Scandinavian Norwegian guy named Leroy Anderson. And that's where all the old animation was stored. There were no doors on it. There was no value particularly placed on it. But you could go to a shelf and pull off a scene from Snow White or 101 Dalmatians or Jungle Book.
When you say a scene, just so people understand,
yes,
it would be a sheaf of animation paper.
Yes. I mean, that's back when animation was done with paper and pencils and 24 frames a second. So there's about 24 drawings per second of animation. Mm-hmm. And so if you have a scene that's on the screen for maybe 5 seconds, then you'd have a stack of 125 drawings to flip through. And you hold it in your left hand and take it in your right hand and flip it. Kind of like if you've ever drawn a little sketch on the bottom of a notebook and flipped it, like a little arrow going across the air and hitting a target or something. It's the same thing. It's not much more complicated, really. But the masters of animation there did it to a degree that no one ever expected. So that was all stored down there, millions of drawings, including backgrounds from Sleeping Beauty. It was stored in ice cream buckets, some of the artwork, and some of it was stored in steamy kind of, there was a room where the boiler and water heater was, and that's where all the really valuable ones like Steamboat Willie and Plane Crazy were stored, because nobody valued it. They just thought, you know, this is a byproduct of making these movies.
Right, right.
And so that was my job, delivering stuff. So somebody would call up, and I'd say, oh, there's this guy named Frank Thomas, and he'd like to have a scene from Jungle Book. So I go to the shelf, pull it off, go up and say, hi, I'm Don, here's the scene. And it would be Frank Thomas, for God's sake, one of the veteran animators and greatest animators of all time. And that's how I started to meet some of the people that were in animation. And a great entree that was.
So that was just a summer job.
Yeah, supposed to be. And I still figure it was a paperwork mistake that I stayed all this time. But it was supposed to be a summer job, and I stayed. I just stayed. I didn't go back to school. I didn't finish my degree, actually.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, that's been a terrible choice you've made.
Yeah, I was lucky. But in the end, the music and art kind of played in my favor because I had a vocabulary to speak with and deal with artists and musicians. And I could have a somewhat logical conversation with Alan Menken or Hans Zimmer or whoever it was. And the first guy I worked with was kind of a circle of life story because I grew up loving Jungle Book and 101 Dalmatians. Those were the movies of my childhood. So when my folks went to the drive-in and we were there in our pajamas in the back of the Rambler station wagon, those were the movies we watched. Mm-hmm. And so I get a call to go up and meet with a guy named Wooly Reitherman, who was directing and producing those movies. And eventually I went to work with him as an assistant director. And that, you know, with him, it meant I got him coffee, got him an occasional cigar, threaded his movie hole, you know, worked with Lorraine, his secretary. And, you know, so there I am, 21 years old, probably at that time, in this room with this giant, I thought, this amazing guy, kind of a John Wayne of a guy, and you know, taking notes and doing whatever I could to help.
It's incredible.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was really lucky.
And you happen to be, you really span, as I say, I often say, it's not history when you're living it.
Right.
You're just showing up every day doing
totally,
your job.
Completely right.
And but you actually spanned, or have spanned now, several eras. I think it's plural now, isn't it, Don? Several eras at the Disney studio.
Mm-hmm.
You came after Walt had died. Walt died in December of 65.
Right.
And by the time you were there in the 70s, it was taken. His son-in-law, the late Ron Miller, was running the studio,
mm-hmm.
and there was a real question as to whether animation would survive at all there.
Yeah, there really was a question. I think Ron Miller and Wooly Reitherman and what we call the Nine Old Men, who are kind mm-hmm. of Walt's key animators, wanted animation to continue, and there was a big recruiting program at the time. People like Brad Bird and a guy named Tim Burton, and those folks came into the studio at that time to kind of replenish the ranks.
Mm-hmm.
They brought in women animators, which was kind of a first at that time. So the 70s were a place where the generations were handing off from one to another.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the screen credits for films like Fox and the Hound from that mm-hmm. time, it lists, you know, guys in their 60s and guys in their 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost a missing generation.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a huge time of transition. And as you said, it was a time when people weren't quite sure animation would go on. It was, if you were, let's say, going out on a date, you wouldn't be caught dead at a Disney animated film.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a kid with a family, that was one thing, but it was not a mainstream movie at all. And there was no competition. Yeah, there were other studios, Ralph Bakshi at certain times and Don Bluth at certain times, but Disney was the place.
Disney owned the category.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. So a real successful movie, you know, like a Fox and the Hound, might have made $20 or $30 million, mm-hmm. Very respectable, but not blockbuster money.
Right.
And then that changed.
Yeah. And now here we are.
And now
today.
To a commercial message.
That's right.
And,
what do you consider the real turning point in that trajectory?
Well, 1984, for me, in my mind anyway, would be the turning point. And that's when Michael Eisner, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Frank Wells, Roy Disney kind of came into the company. Ron Miller exited in, I think, a very difficult kind of situation. Ron Miller and the Walt side of the family and Roy Disney and the Roy side of the family never completely got along. Mm-hmm. I think that would have been the dream for their fathers, to have the boys kind of take over the company, mm-hmm. but there was not a good chemistry there. So in 1984, Stanley Gold, who was Roy Disney's attorney, and Roy kind of orchestrated a takeover and a buyout of the company.
This is Roy Edward Disney.
Roy Edward Disney, who
the son of the co-founder.
Yes, Roy O. Disney.
That's mm-hmm. why you'll always hear people, when referring to the Roys, with an initial, because otherwise we don't know who the hell is who.
Yeah.
Though I went to school with Roy the Fourth, and so in my house he's my Roy.
Oh, yeah.
That's how we differentiate.
No, I'm jealous.
But though, this was the crazy thing about my dad knowing Diane yeah. Disney Miller, and then me going to school with the Roy side.
Yeah.
I knew both sides of the family, and they didn't know each other.
Yeah,
so when
true.
I would see my Roy, his sisters, you know, I grew up with all of them since I was really little.
Mm-hmm.
I think Roy and I started in kindergarten together.
Wow.
And our school, our pavilion was the Roy O. Disney Pavilion.
Of course, yes.
Of course it was. But, you know, I would say, oh, I was just with your Aunt Diane. They didn't know who they would either
yeah.
only kind of know, but it was such a trip to be with both sides
exactly.
of the family. Same thing to know Joanna Miller, one of their daughters.
Yeah.
Same thing. I know one side and the other side. It's very strange.
And by themselves, they're really sweet people.
They're
and,
all
and
lovely.
Amazing.
They're all lovely
and
people.
And there was just always a little rub of some sort, and
yeah.
who knows what that was.
Yeah.
But that was, to me, the turning point for animation at the studio and for a lot of things.
Sure.
Because you have some very savvy businessmen coming into the company in the form of Frank Wells and Michael Eisner. And they formed a team that was somewhat like Walt and Roy. And then the animation division was pretty much given to Roy Disney. He said, well, you guys are rejuvenating the live action division while you guys are rejuvenating the parks and starting things like, you know, videotape and that kind of thing. Give me animation. So he and Jeffrey Katzenberg really are the two guys that I think really kicked us in the bottom to, I'm just searching for my words, to be able to kind of start making these movies.
Right.
And they literally started by kicking us off the lot. And that was odd because we were in this animation building that was built with the prophets from Snow White, the Seven Dwarves, and it even said animation on the door. And you're doing what? And you're moving in Bette Midler and Robin Williams, and what's going on here? But we did. We moved off the lot to a bunch of warehouses in beautiful Glendale, California. Mm-hmm. And there we sat, and we were in these warehouses. There was, you know, minimal air conditioning, and there's all our furniture, and we thought, holy, it's sink or swim, and it doesn't look good. It really doesn't. So that was a big turning point, and it could have gone either way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, to Roy's credit and a lot of really great people, they invested time and money in animation and training and in bringing people in like Howard Ashman and Alan Menken, who made this huge difference in teaching us how to make musicals and animation again.
Yeah, using the template of the classic Broadway musical.
Completely. Yeah, we didn't know we would make an animated film, a perfectly good film like Great Mouse Detective.
Mm-hmm. Say, yeah.
And put songs in it and say, yeah. Oh, we're in a little pub, let's have a song. But we didn't really understand the underpinnings of it. And we made films like Black Cauldron. It has a lot of good work in it, but it didn't cut through, and there's a few faults with it. So in comes Howard Ashman and Alan, but really Howard, who was an amazing guy, and said, no, here's what you do. And he sat down, literally sat down in front of us when Little Mermaid started and said, let me tell you what to do. You know where to put the songs? It's where the characters can't help but sing. Mm-hmm. So it's the high points in their life when they're falling in love or they've lost everything or the villain's hatching his or her plot. And those are where you put the songs. You don't stop the movie to sing. Those songs catapult you into the next act. And that was like, really? And the lead character, the second song in the film is an I Want song. An I Want song, really? We had never heard of that. So it sounds ridiculous now. But
No, not at all.
It was a different thing.
It's a different thing.
And as you said, based on Broadway.
Now, so this is known. Anybody who wants to read up about it can in many different sources. What isn't known to us is how did you advance? How did you, riding along this train that's picking up speed, how did you become an associate producer and then ultimately a producer of these films?
Wow. I honestly haven't talked about this in ages, if ever. I had been the production manager on Great Mouse Detective, which was a real turning point. We loved that movie, and Bernie Mattinson, the director, was an amazing guy, still is. It was one of the first movies that John Musker and Ron Clements, who went on to do many, many Disney movies.
Ron and John
directed on. Mm-hmm. So we had a great experience. At the end of that movie, Eisner and Wells and Katzenberg were there, had moved in. And there was one story idea that Steven Spielberg loved and Bob Zemeckis, who had done Back to the Future, loved, and it was Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Mm-hmm. But they had no experience making live-action animation combination because nobody had really done it since Mary Poppins, except for Pete's Dragon.
Right.
And I had worked on Pete's Dragon with Don Bluth, the great animation director. And so they said, you need to go over and hang out at this place called Amblin. It's on the Universal lot. And they're trying to work out this Who Framed Roger Rabbit film. So, you know, little Donnie Hahn from Bellflower, California, is sitting in the room with Steven Spielberg and Richard Williams and Bob Zemeckis and all these people. Because I knew how to connect the dots and at least knew the technique of making these movies. Mm-hmm. I'm an artist, but I was never a great animator. So I saw pretty early in my career that I wasn't going to be Glenn Keane or Andreas Deja. Mm-hmm. And so I got more into producing and production. And it was Frank Marshall at the time that just said, well, you'll be our associate producer. I said, okay. And I had to go home and kind of look that up. But that was a huge break, working with those guys. And I learned so much from Zemeckis and Richard Williams and Spielberg. I really owe them a lot from my career. So I moved to London. I had a lot of personal transitions in my life.
Which is where Richard Williams was headquartered.
Yeah, Richard was there. And the Disney studio was occupied with Little Mermaid and Oliver and company. So we didn't want to take anything away in terms of animators or resources to do this fringe film that may or may not hit called Roger Rabbit. So I moved to London for 2 years and worked with Richard, which was a hoot. And I think I'm probably the only producer, I think this is true, that's ever helped Richard complete a movie. he's worked on many movies and all that stuff. But I, and people really always had fallings out, whatever that is, with him. But I love the guy, and he was, and still is, really brilliant.
He's a brilliant guy.
A brilliant guy. And he played the cornet.
And a jazz cornet player.
He loved Bix Beiderbecke, and he loved all this jazz. So on weekends, he would say, oh, I'm going up to the Grosvenor House with my band, Dick Six, kind of like Firehouse Five plus two,
yeah.
Dick Six.
Yeah.
And he said, would you like to play drums? Because my drummer isn't here. So I would go up and have, you know, a lunch and sit in with Dick and his band. And I think that was a bonding thing for us. So, to this day, I have so much respect for him. And he made a great movie. Roger Rabbit is, it was probably the hardest thing I ever worked on, but it was really a wonderful time if you talk to anybody that worked on it.
Let me tell you an experience. I don't think I've told this story before. If I have, I apologize. I got a telephone call from an old friend, a publicist at Disney, mm-hmm. 2 weeks before that movie opened, knowing that I was going to be reviewing it at Entertainment Tonight, mm-hmm. and said, now, this is not a Disney movie. I want to make sure you make that clear. This is not a Walt Disney Studio movie. This is an Amblin production. Mm-hmm. And
for anyone who doesn't know, Amblin is
Steven Spielberg.
Yes, thank you.
In the event that you do not know that.
That's true.
Because it was the name of his first successful short subject.
Yes.
It's an Amblin production, mm-hmm. In association with Touchstone Pictures.
All shrouded in secrecy.
Which was Walt Disney Studios' brand, mm-hmm. for so-called non-Disney, non-family-friendly entertainment.
Yeah.
So, okay. I said, okay, fine. I'll play along. Okay, fine. The instant it became a success, which was the instant it opened, mm-hmm. and it became a smash and got on the cover of Time magazine, mm-hmm. it was a Disney movie.
Yes, it was.
Isn't it funny how that happens?
It's funny how that happens. And yeah, the, you know, Toontown at Disneyland was Roger Rabbit, mm-hmm. But that didn't happen until the movie opened. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were lucky. It was great.
What a smash.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's Bob Zemeckis at his best, fearlessly getting into an area of technology that he just jumped into and moved the camera, did things that we never did on Peace Dragon, or they never did on Mary Poppins.
It still looks good, by the way.
It still looks good.
There are times you watch something and newer technology, you go, okay, I can kind of see. I mean, little things like fog or someone's breath.
Right.
You know, it's not as seamless as it is now.
Right.
But man, Roger Rabbit, it still looks that good.
It holds up.
And it's also Bob Hoskins, which is just one of the greatest
actors ever.
Yeah.
And so friendly to the animation process. He lived in Islington, which was the next town over from Camden Town where we were. And he would come by and visit. And the studio became this place where George Lucas would come by and visit. And Jim Henson would come by and visit. And because it was – animation was still really new.
Yeah.
And in London, there was a commercial doing adverts for television kind of industry, but not a feature industry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a novelty. And when I look back, I marvel how we got it done. But we did. I think we got it done because, like Bumblebee Flight, we didn't know that we couldn't do it. And so mm-hmm. we just did it.
That Bumblebee flies anyway.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And, little moment here, you got to work with Stubby K.
Oh, yeah.
Which in our family is the highest of honors.
I can see why.
That is.
Well, Stubby K and Mae Questel, who did Betty Boop's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway through production, I went over to Mel Blanc's house, and Mel and his son Noel, and recorded Yosemite Sam and Bugs Bunny and, Wayne Allwine, who did the voice of Mickey Mouse at the time. So, it's what you said a few minutes ago. When you're doing it, it's not history. When you're mm-hmm. doing it, it's like, oh, I got to drive down to Beverly Hills to Mel Blanc's house.
Right.
Oh, I'm running late. And, but you look back and you go, holy whatever, that was Mel Blanc.
Yeah.
And I feel so lucky.
In that instant especially, holy shit, it's Mel Blanc.
Thank you for saying that.
You can do it, my friend.
Holy
because
shit.
When it's Mel Blanc,
it
was holy
shit.
Yeah.
These people, it's if you are someone who loves animation, mm-hmm. if you are someone who likes animation, there are certain names, like the Nine Old Men,
mm-hmm.
there are certain names that they are icons, legends, we don't like to use these words loosely because some people do. That's not... These things wouldn't exist.
Yes.
You know, they wouldn't exist. And it's insane to me. You know, in the same way, speaking to Floyd Norman, like you, he went through different phases of Disney and then Pixar and lots of others. And it's just like, if you are in a room with John Lasseter, Tim Burton, Brad Bird, you don't know then that these three people are going to do what they're going to do.
No.
You have no idea. You don't know when someone says, do you want to produce one of these kinds of movies?
No.
Okay.
No idea.
You don't know that all these years later. We were just with Willie Ito the other day, and a friend said, tell him what you did. Well, he animated one of the most famous scenes ever, Lady and the Tramp eating the spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a person where if you walk by him, you don't know that. But that scene is imitated. It's one of the most visually iconic in ever. He's right there.
And one of the most humble people you'd ever meet.
One of the loveliest, sweetest people in the world.
Exactly.
So this brings, after Roger Rabbit, you get your shot to be an actual producer on Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
And we've talked about that enormous success.
Yeah.
And
what is a producer when it comes to animation?
I don't have a clue. No, it's you know, you're like the coach on a football team or a soccer team. So you're usually the first person on, and I was the first person on Beauty, and you put together the team. So originally I pulled together directors and writers and some story people, and you try to get a little development group together of 5 or 10 people, a couple of artists. And so I did. We pulled together in a director whose name was Richard Purdom. He was a protege of Richard Williams, the director of Roger Rabbit, and his wife, who was a producer, and some great artists from London. Michael Dudok DeWitt, who later won an Oscar for his short, and some great people to develop the show. And I pulled over to London, actually. We started developing Beauty in London with Glenn Keane and Andreas Deja and Tom Cito and Mel Shaw, one of the great visual development artists of Disney. And it just crashed. It just tanked. It was, it was beautifully done, but it was a little too serious, a little too Masterpiece Theater, and it never quite connected that early version. Mm-hmm. So we made some painful changes and switched over to Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale as directors, who were CalArts kids and kind of came in with that Brad Bird, Tim Burton kind of group and kind of young, hungry. I mean, they were kids in their 20s. We all were. And put together the crew, and they got it. And also, Little Mermaid came out right then. Mm-hmm. And Jeffrey Katzenberg, to his credit, talked Howard Ashman into doing Beauty and the Beast. This is a long story, but I'll tell it. The next movie after Little Mermaid was supposed to be Aladdin. And they wrote their songs for Aladdin, beautiful songs. And that story crashed. For some reason in animation, stories don't work out right the first time. And so Howard Nalander is sitting there with nothing to do. And we were ready to go in. So we had to hire a songwriter. And we knew we couldn't get Howard now because they were on Aladdin. So luckily for us, Aladdin fell apart. We were able to pull them into Beauty and the Beast. And what an experience that was. Because the first song tape they sent in, that's back when we had cassette tapes, it was Belle and Be Our Guest on the first tape. And so you put it in and listen to it. And you just go, this is operetta. This is... And it's storytelling. Mm-hmm. It made our job easy. I'm just admitting it. It made our job easy because Howard had laid out the whole opening, and you meet Belle, and you meet the villain Gaston and his sidekick LeFou, and you meet Belle's father, and you meet the provincial town. And by the end of it, you're set up for this movie. So that was our kind of good luck that got us into the starting gates for Beauty and the Beast.
And you also did something that was, I guess, was still considered unusual. You actually hired a screenwriter.
Crazy.
and a woman to boot.
Also crazy.
A woman. Yes.
Linda Wolverton.
Yeah.
And we should explain for those who don't know that in animation, traditionally, story is kind of a patchwork quilt process. And,
well said.
And it was under Walt's regime, and for many years after, it was done through drawings. Oodles and oodles of storyboard drawings, like a giant comic strip or comic book. Mm-hmm. And it was not written down in a script or screenplay form.
No, No, it wasn't. We had there were writers, like when I was working with Woolley, but they were like Larry Clemens, who was a gag writer for Bing Crosby at one time. So he would write gags or lines of dialogue. But what Linda did, and around that time, I think because of Roy Disney, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Peter Schneider, who was there at the time, there was a focus on kind of joining the movie business. So getting screenwriters meant we had to think
out of the kitchen.
Yes, out of the kitchen into the adult table, which was terrifying. But we had to deal with things like structure and character development and that. So Linda, again, very young at the beginning of her career, came in and was a collaborator at the table. And in animation, we work like television, where you have everybody around a table more. There's no ivory tower writers. They're there with you. And that was great. And there's, it's not an easy process. There was a lot of screaming and yelling and you know, in a productive way to try to say, no, this idea. Well, how about that idea? Well, what if this teapot talks and it can sing also? And and we named her Mrs. Chamomile. And we decided to change it because we thought the kids couldn't pronounce chamomile.
Chamomile. I like that idea, Mrs. Chamomile.
Yeah, it was very warm and kind of nurturing.
Yeah.
Became Mrs. Potts, and Chandal, the French candelabra, became Lumiere, and Cogsworth was always Cogsworth. So those kinds of characters grew out of those sessions from some really brilliant people.
Man. And then you just went from strength to strength. I mean, there was a period there when it was like the New York Yankees.
When I was a kid, it was nonstop.
Yeah,
that was when I was a kid. It was all the time, and the premieres would happen, and we'd go to the El Cap, or they'd do it on the lot.
Yep.
You know, that was a huge part of my life growing up. Were those movies coming out?
And then The Lion King came out and made so much money.
Because they got Jonathan Taylor Thomas,
Yeah. He was the linchpin,
That'll do it.
It did.
It made so much money, it turned everybody's head.
Yeah. It did.
And it turned them a little too far, perhaps.
People got into the animation business that perhaps shouldn't have gotten into the animation business, which is still lively today, by the way. Yeah. you know, the thing about Lion King is I couldn't get anybody to work on it. So after Beauty and the Beast, as everybody applauds, it's great. Aladdin got its act together. And so it comes out. Robin Williams is huge, great animation by Eric Goldberg and Ron and John again directing it. And we were developing Pocahontas at the same time. And we split the crew because there was so much production happening. And there was so much hunger for animation. And there was this thing called videotape that started to come. So home entertainment is you could take these things home. And that was a huge cash cow for the company. So we used to do these wine and cheese things at nighttime. And we put up all the artwork for the movie. So we put up our Lion King stuff. And it was a little dusty and National Geographic in a not so good way. And Pocahontas, though, was like Romeo and Juliet meets Dances with Wolves. And it's got Alan Menken writing the songs. And it's just a no-brainer, and everybody wanted to work on Pocahontas. Lion King, on the other hand, it's an experiment. We have to break out once in a while. The story is really kind of Joseph meets, from the Bible, meets Moses, meets Hamlet, with that great African composer, Elton John.
I love him.
He's really good. Yeah. Very indigenous.
That kid is going places.
He's going places. So it was a head-scratcher for a lot of people. And Leanne Lebo.
Lebo,
who does that Cry in the Wilderness at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Who was a refugee.
Cry of the Wilderness.
Yes.
That's what that's called.
It is.
That thing that everyone does.
Yes.
When you hold up any animal of any kind.
Everyone does that cry.
Nah, we can all do it. Yeah.
Oh, that was pretty good.
Thank you. I've practiced.
I mean, Lebo came from Hans Zimmer. So Hans Zimmer comes in and arranges all of Elton's songs. Elton has this amazing gift for melody. Tim Rice originally was the first musician on the show, and he wanted to bring in ABBA.
That would have made a very different movie.
So he had worked with ABBA in Chess, his Broadway musical, and they're great guys and girls, and seriously exchanged letters and artwork and everything else, and eventually they said, we're doing an album, it's not going to work, and that's when we went to Elton John. Yeah, it's a head shaker.
A little part of me wants to know, though, what ABBA
what
would
have sounded
like.
I know.
Because I'm now picturing the moves. Well, what's in my mind is Mamma Mia animated with lions.
Mamma Mia Mufasa.
There you go.
Yeah,
oh, very
that's
good.
That's the new
good.
Title, actually.
That's
yeah.
right.
That's the next one. We don't want to
spill the beans.
No,
it
sorry.
Is.
So a lot of perfect storms started happening on that movie. I think because people didn't want to work on it, we got a very hungry group of animators that worked on it who maybe would not have gotten a chance had it been populated with these A-list animators, because it was seen as the B-movie,
yeah.
totally.
Hmm.
So we got Andreas Deja, who's brilliant. James Baxter, who animated Rafiki, who I hired on Roger Rabbit, is brilliant. And a slew of animators that really contributed to that film. And we got Hans Zimmer to arrange in an amazing African way all of Elton's music. And he brought in Lebo M, who was a refugee from Africa. Apartheid was happening at the time. And Lebo was in Los Angeles looking for work, and he was begging, literally, on Hollywood and Vine, thinking, someday I want to go into these recording studios and do something. He was working McDonald's. He was working parking cars. And Hans pulled him in and had him work on the vocals. And the rest is history.
He signed my debt. I don't know if you do the same, but we save all of our lanyards from everything.
Too.
He signed my dad's Lion King lanyard. I remember that, and we still have it. And it was one of those things, oh my God.
His story is amazing because
it is.
In 1994, when the film came out, the vote to kill apartheid happened in April of that year, and the movie came out in July. So he voted for the first time in his life when Lion King came out. And he was in tears when that happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And there's another one, though. It holds up, and people are obsessed. And it's one where the stage show took on a whole other life. And
well, that's Julie Taymor. Tom Schumacher, who runs the theatrical division, had worked with her at the LA Olympics Arts Festival and brought her in. And we always used to joke when we were making the movie that there'd be like a Lion King ice show. You know, like Mufasa with
Cubs on ice.
Yeah, like a big rubber head or something like that. But what Julie did was say, let's show you not only the character, the puppet of the character, but the person that's manipulating the character, and that you would buy that as an audience, that you would take that leap of faith and say, that guy with the Mufasa head is both Mufasa and his soul, almost.
Yeah.
Or that gazelle wheel that comes out on stage, it looks like a bicycle contraption, and all the gazelles are kind of leaping. So it's this very visual form of puppetry that was she had put together from all these influences around the world, Bunraku and Balinese shadow puppets and all these things. Yeah. And that show is like goes and goes and goes. It's running every night of the week around the world to this day.
I was 12. Mm-hmm. We were in New York. We were back east visiting family, and I was 12 and we went and saw it.
Yeah.
And you're crying and they're coming down the aisles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing is, and this is part of what makes Disney, is that they did things before everybody else did things.
Yeah.
And as much as a lot of people, for whatever reason, don't want to give credit where it's due, there were so many pieces. Immersive theater in that way was not what it is now, where people coming from the back is constant. You know, the only time I'd heard about it was my mom always talks about Ethel Merman entering from the back for Gypsy. But, you know, being in a theater when you have animals coming down the aisles and things are flying, it blows your mind. And the music is incredible. It is. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, Disney even, you know, from a business standpoint, would do things like redo the New Amsterdam Theater,
which
was derelict, and the ceiling was open and pigeons were flying in, so that there would be a venue for something
like that. Did you keep them, though? Because for The Lion King, it might...
We did not,
no.
Well,
could have saved you money, see?
Yeah, no.
You needed me.
I do. I still do. So anyway, there was that kind of nice meeting of faith in the arts, faith in what was a fringe artist, like Julie Taymor.
Yeah.
Even somebody like Hans Zimmer, he had done, you know, movies like Thelma and Louise and Backdraft and Driving Miss Daisy, but he had never done animation, and he ends up winning an Oscar for Lion King. So
there's
incredible.
The risk is a big part of the recipe.
And what happened around that time, though, is because of its unprecedented financial success, I think the number was $300 million then?
I think we made it to four.
Yeah, wow. And that's 20-something years ago dollars.
25, yeah, 25 years ago.
It really did some damage, mm-hmm. let's say, to people's egos, mm-hmm. to the infrastructure, to a lot of different, to relationships.
Yes.
And that's what you cover in your fascinating documentary, Waking Sleeping Beauty. Mm. And Waking Sleeping Beauty is the story of this whole period and this transitional time at the second transitional time at Disney, when the new regime had schisms and, you know, departures and disagreements. And
my dad and I were talking about it, and he said only you could have gotten those interviews with everybody.
I don't know why, but that turned out to be true.
Well, you do know why.
All the players would still talk to you.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case with other people. And it's true what you said about, you know, money reveals, money corrupts in some cases. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it was it did affect a lot of egos and a lot of partnerships and things mm-hmm. that you thought would be rock solid and just weren't. At the same time, Frank Wells passed away in a helicopter accident, sadly. Mm. So and all these tensions started to build up. I never in a million years thought I would tell that story. But 20 years later, 15 mm-hmm. years later, I thought this is a story that should be preserved. And it started out saying, I'm just going to cut together these clips and home movies and stick it on a shelf in the archives because it's worth it. Mm-hmm. And then people like Dick Cook, who ran the studio at the time, Peter Schneider was one of my collaborators on that film, really encouraged me to pull together the whole story and gave me the funding and the distribution to be able to actually make a movie out of it, mm-hmm. which was a real leap of faith. I hadn't directed a documentary before in my life, but more than anyone, I felt confident because I knew the story.
Yeah.
And I was able to call up the people, and whether it was Jeffrey or Peter Schneider or Roy Disney or rank and file animators, because I want to present a courtroom story and let the audience decide if there were heroes and villains. Mm-hmm. There's no need for me to villainize or anything, because I think people in the film spoke for themselves.
Yeah.
And I used no narrator for that reason. I just wanted the testimony to be straight from the horse's mouth. So it was an experience. I'm really proud of that movie, and it's quite a story.
Now you have, I think part of your nature is you have a sense of history, mm-hmm. and especially where Disney's concerned, you have a sense of history and continuity, because you've also written several books, mm-hmm. including a compendium of the animation lectures that were given in the 1930s when Walt wanted to sort of prepare his animators for the next leap forward in terms of getting them out of just being able to draw Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck.
Yeah.
To being able to breathe life into mm-hmm. characters that you would spend more time with in a feature-length film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm crazy about untold stories. Mm-hmm. And the last few years, I've been doing almost exclusively documentaries because of that. I love giving a voice to people that don't have a voice or mm-hmm. can't speak anymore. I love bringing people back to life again in a documentarian, journalistic kind of way. And that book that you spoke of, the Before Ever After, is about a guy named Don Graham who ran that training program. And Walt, during the Depression, was spending $1 million a year on training. Mm. It's an astronomical amount of money on training to get his artists better. And in doing so, he trained not only his artists, but as they left and populated the animation industry, it ended up training the whole animation industry in Los Angeles. Yeah. Don Graham was an instructor artist who taught at Chouinard. Chouinard was a small art school in Los Angeles. Run by Nelbert Chouinard. And 30 years after Walt was spending all this money on training, Chouinard had some financial troubles, and Walt ended up buying it and renaming it CalArts mm-hmm. because education was always
California Institute of the Arts.
Exactly right.
But everyone calls it CalArts.
CalArts, yeah.
Yeah. He felt like there's a Caltech for science. Why isn't there a CalArts for the arts?
Mm-hmm. And he was right.
And he was mm-hmm. right. And so he, for a guy who never made it further than the eighth grade, he was really into education. Mm-hmm. And that fascinated me. So that's what that story is about. And I also knew in the morgue, where I started out as a kid, there were these stacks of lectures transcribed. And they were sitting there on the shelf, and nobody knew about them. And I just thought, people need to know about these. They need to read them. There's a whole animation industry coming up, and to hide this kind of light under a bushel is not the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so to put it out there and share as a – I'm not a historian. I'm not a academic, but to put it out
there.
You are, though. I'm not the way you guys are. I mean, you're...
Don't put me in. Come on now.
Well, Leonard, you are. There's historians that are deeply involved into the fabric of film history. I'm not that person. But I love telling those stories that have been untold, and that Don Graham story about the training in Walt Disney was one of them.
And you also wrote a book on creativity.
Mm-hmm. I did. That was crazy. And it's, you know, it's somewhat of a memoir of the people I had worked with, because mm-hmm. I thought, so here I've worked with Sting and Elton John and Howard Ashman and all these actors and amazing animators, people whose names you may not know, like Ken Anderson and, you know, animators like Eric Larson. And I thought, I need to tell their story because of who they were. They weren't animation fans, because there was no animation when they were growing up. They were artists, and they were not fanboys. They were men. You know, Wooly Reitherman was a pilot in the Second World War. And, you know, Ward Kimball had a full-size steam train in his backyard. Mm-hmm. These were guys with larger-than-life interests outside of animation. And I had to write about that. Howard Ashman was a theatrical director. When he came out of school in Indiana State, he opened his own theater in New York. You know, so he's a kid in his 20s. I'm going to move to New York and not just work in the theater. I'll just open my own theater. Hmm. And I'll put on shows like Little Shop of Horrors. You know, so these entrepreneurial, fearless men and women of that era, I just thought, you have to talk about that and my experiences with them and their failures. You know, we had the first version of Circle of Life that came in was, I'm sorry, Elton, but it really was awful. Mm-hmm. So we went back to the drawing board and said, you know, maybe our direction was wrong, but let's rewrite it. And he did. And he came back with a new version that actually is in the movie. But there's a lot of failures, a lot of missteps, a lot of chaos that goes into making these movies. And I thought that was important to talk about.
Well, I think that that's the most inspirational thing you can share with people. When you share failure, it inspires them, because yeah. if you failed but continued on and created something, then everybody can fail. You basically, you tell people they're allowed to fail.
Yeah.
A lot of
yeah.
people feel like that's not an option.
Oh, man. You almost want to fail, although that's not true, but you do want to allow yourself to take risks, and sometimes those
yeah.
risks don't pay off.
Yeah.
yeah.
And in the movie business, that is seems like it's unusually true, especially in animation.
Yeah.
If you talk to anybody at Disney or Pixar or really any studio, it takes 4 and 5 times to put a movie up on its feet before it starts to feel like the movie. And there's horror stories about Toy Story or Lion King or, you know, name a title that didn't come together until its 4th or 5th iteration. But that's the strength of animation. You can iterate.
You wrote a book about that, too.
Yeah. Yes.
You wrote a lot of books, huh?
I don't know why.
You did, but you wrote something called very aptly titled The Alchemy of Animation.
Yeah. Well, that was
an animated film in the modern age.
And that was for students, really, because I mm-hmm. found a lot of kids would come up after or their parents and say, I have a daughter that's interested in animation. Mm. I have a son who's a painter, and they're in art school. What do they do? And so I thought, I'm going to write a book for 14-year-olds and executives, because everybody was getting into the animation business. So every studio executive at Paramount, DreamWorks, and everywhere else bought that book because it was the primer on animation and yeah. just went into not only hand-drawn animation, but computer animation, stop-motion animation, and just said, here's the basics. So if you're interested in a career in it, or if you were just assigned to run an animation department in a studio, you can read this and kind of get the basics of it all. Because I couldn't stand it otherwise.
And your latest book is called Yesterday's Tomorrow. Disney's magical mid-century, and really, as a boy who went to the New York World's Fair 12 times,
I am so jealous.
He's obsessed.
I was so hooked on that fair, and of course, especially the Disney attractions there.
Yeah,
that I couldn't get enough of it. So that's mid-century modern right there.
And I'm hooked on mid-century modern. My wife and I live in like a Mr. Incredibles house.
Do you really?
Yeah, it's like a 40s, has, you know, terrazzo floors, and it's very mid-century modern. And mm-hmm. I love that kind of architecture. And I have architecture almost as a hobby because I just love it. So this it's actually, Leonard, a movie, a book about you and my life, mm-hmm. Because I grew up in Southern California. And Southern California was the land of sunshine and experimental architecture.
Yeah.
And architects like Neutra and Schindler and Frank Lloyd Wright built houses here. And it was cheap land, wealthy clients, and sunshine.
Yeah.
And that was an incredible story to tell. And part of that story was Disney, Disneyland. And as you said, the World's Fair, which Disney contributed to and pieces of which came back to Disneyland. So to me, it was an era when Disney was on fire. It was television happened during that era, his ABC television deal. They built Disneyland in 11 months. The publishing business, music publishing started. They were publishing soundtracks to movies. Nobody had ever done that before. Consumer products, all those things were happening, and the studio was absolutely on fire in that kind of post-war era.
Right.
And people were flooding into Southern California. It was a land of optimism, young families coming in, huge tracts of housing were being built, moving south from the city, and that's, of course, where Disneyland went. Mm-hmm. So I was just fascinated by that era, partially because that was my childhood and growing up, and I thought, what was Disney's contribution to the culture of that era?
Yeah.
And that's what that book's about.
The answer is huge.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the way that the buildings are on the lot here, I mean, they're distinct. They're beautiful. Disney doesn't look like any other lot.
And it happened that Michael Eisner was an architecture buff, too.
He was.
And he commissioned some pretty cool work while he was in charge.
He did. You know, he was fearless about bringing in Frank Gehry and you know, any number of architects, Robert Stern, who did the animation building. Taking risks with animation.
Yeah.
That architecture made a statement.
Uh-huh.
And it was a visual statement.
Yeah.
And it was a visual arts company. And you know, Walt certainly did that with a new studio in Burbank when he built that.
That was the last word in modernism.
It was streamlined modern.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know, he had sailed on the Normandy a couple of years earlier, and now Snow White makes all this money, and he ends up building this amazing stylized studio and the furniture to go with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I love that era, especially the mid-century.
He's a nut and has made me.
I'm so jealous you went to that World's Fair. I went to Seattle,
and I didn't get to go to Seattle.
So that was great.
Yeah,
but that was about it. But New York was the place. If you were anybody, you went to the New York World's Fair. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, fortunately, I lived close enough to be able to do it.
Have you been to Weta?
Yes.
Because that's the other one that we saw and just went,
yeah.
It's perfect.
It is.
It's perfect.
Now, tell us about your documentary about Howard Ashman and how and when we might see it.
Wow. Well, as I said earlier, I love giving a voice to people who maybe no longer have a voice. Mm-hmm. And Howard had a very powerful voice. I also knew we had a lot of footage in the archives of Howard. I had hours of tape of Howard and all this media. And no one had done a biography or a book. No one had done a film. No one had told his story. Mm-hmm. So I knew his sister and his Sarah and his mate Billy a little bit. And I called them up and said, I saw them at this animation conference called CTN that happens in Burbank every year. And I don't know why, but I just said, I'm going to make a movie about Howard. It was like an impulse buy. You know how you buy like the gum at the checkout stand?
Yeah.
I think I felt like I owed Howard so much in my personal career that I wouldn't be where I was without Howard. Was part of it. And I also felt it was a great story to tell. Here's a man who is from Baltimore, Jewish, goes to school in Indiana, gay, moves to New York, has his own theater company, and ends up writing some of the most iconic Disney music ever while he's dying of AIDS in the height of the AIDS crisis. That's a story, and it's a story I lived through. And so I felt like I just had to tell it, and it is one of those things you have to do. So I spent the last 3 years probably pulling that movie together and getting, in my usual Waking Sleeping Beauty way, testimony from Jeffrey Katzenberg and Peter Schneider and actors that have worked with him, and cutting all that together into a documentary called Simply Howard. Mm-hmm. And we premiered it last year at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it was a really emotional experience because especially premiering in New York, the theater community there turned out for it, the gay community turned out for it, the LGBT community, and it was very... such an untold story to a degree, but a story everybody could relate to. And sadly, it's a story as much about the AIDS crisis affecting the creative community as it is about Howard. So it got a great reception there, and it'll be out later this year. We've been working really hard with one of the major new streaming services yet to be announced, and it'll be out later this year. You can probably connect the dots on that one, but it'll be a terrific international release to tell Howard's story.
Wow. How wonderful.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I have to send it to you guys so you can see it.
He's a fascinating fellow because the name is not as well known as you'd think it would be, considering how much he was a part of. And I don't remember how old I was when I found out he'd passed away. Because it definitely was, I didn't know when it happened.
Yeah.
I was too young, I think.
Right.
But figuring out as I started to learn names, as I started to realize that in my household you had to know the names and it couldn't just be that guy, that girl.
Right.
I remember finding out that he'd passed away and I was very confused by it. Mm. And then, of course, being in the Disney world that we are, you don't hear his name very often.
Yeah.
Though Alan Menken does, I think, a really good job of bringing him up.
He does.
He doesn't.
I mean, we know
he doesn't forget him.
He doesn't at all. Alan's a real mensch when it comes to that. He keeps his memory alive, realizes that his career in large part is because of Howard.
Exactly. And that's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And when I interviewed him, it's, you know, many of the interviews are very emotional because of that. But also, Howard was one of the funniest people you've ever met. So it's the film's largely a celebration of Howard's life that's bittersweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's
because he's gone, and that's how that's going to be.
Because he's gone, and hopefully the film will be a piece of keeping his story alive.
Mm-hmm. It will be, but that is why it's so important that these things exist.
Yeah, yeah, thank
that
you.
Is.
Now, we don't have time to go to every one of your credits or every one of your films, and I wish we did, but there's one that makes me smile, not only because I like the movie, but because it's another circle of life. Mm-hmm. You got to produce the live-action feature-length Frankenweenie.
Yes.
With Tim Burton.
Yes.
With whom you started out at the studio decades earlier.
Yeah. Oh, man, what a story that is. I obviously knew about Frankenweenie. It was a short. It was a live-action short. Very experimental. But I think to Ron Miller's credit and a guy named Tom Wilhite. Who doesn't get enough credit, who really shepherded along films like Splash and Tron and some really interesting films, saw in Tim Burton a talent that no one could describe and still can't, and gave him the chance to do a couple shorts. He did a short about Vincent Price called Vincent. Mm-hmm. He did this short called Frankenweenie. And it got a limited release, and it sat there for 25 years. And I had worked with Tim on and off and just, you know, followed him to some of his gallery openings when he was at MoMA in New York and said hello. We were never close, but, you know, like everyone, we were colleagues in animation. And I went to him one day. I actually had two drawings. I said, I held up Frankenweenie, and I said, Tim Burton's Frankenweenie as a feature. He said, oh, that's good. And I held up a Mark Davis drawing of Maleficent. And I said, Walt Disney's Maleficent. And he said, give me that. And he grabbed the drawing and I pinned it up on his wall. Because Tim was the first director of Maleficent.
Really?
And couldn't do it because of a scheduling thing. But it was very interested in that story and that character, which you can imagine why he would be.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. The cheekbones alone.
Just cheekbones. So it screams Tim, actually. Cheekbones and horns. That's
basically.
That's all he does. So the Frankenweenie story is he leapt at it. He said, yeah, you know, there's an idea to expand the kids. I always want to do that. And Tim's very loyal to his story ideas. So it was almost like he just dropped it yesterday and picked it up again. He's also very loyal to his collaborators. So Rick Heinrichs, who doesn't get enough ink, is a brilliant art director who came into Frankenweenie then and started developing it visually. And that movie started coming together a little reluctantly on the studio's part. It took a long time. Dick Cook loves Tim Burton and wanted to do it, but it was a stop-motion feature. It was in black and white. Budget wasn't big. And I actually went out and found some financiers that would raise the money for it. And I said, Dick, I can raise the money for this. If the studio doesn't want to pay for it, would the studio distribute it? And then he said, nah, you don't have to do that. We'll pay for it. So it was like a forced negotiation to say, somebody else will do this if you don't. And to his credit, he jumped in, and so did Tim. So we made it in London again and had a great time with some amazing stop-motion animators. puppet makers and recreated this world from Tim's childhood. Everybody loves their dog when they're a kid, and this is the biggest probably love story between man and beast, you know, except for Beauty and the Beast. Maybe I'm just make stories like that.
You stick to beasts.
Yeah, I do.
Beasts.
I do.
It's a niche market.
Yeah. And Tim's remarkable. You know, I think Tim somewhat, he's very introverted and a very private person. He almost plays a character when he's out in public because when he works, no one has a better work ethic than Tim. He shows up. He works hard. He really cares about the product. He surrounds himself with people who understand his style. And he, you can tell by the amount of work he's turned out in his career and the just the variety of it all, that he really cares about what he does and is passionate about it. And he was on that movie. Allison Abadi was our producer on that film, my executive producer. And Allison runs animation at Warner Brothers now. So a very gifted group of people, many of which worked on Nightmare Before Christmas, another Tim movie, worked on Frankenweenie.
Well, I'm glad for I'm glad you did.
Thanks.
And I know I'm not alone in that. You have so many irons in the fire, and you keep surprising us with new ideas, and sometimes new ideas rooted in old and valid ideas that are due for a second outing or refreshing or rebooting, I'm just an unabashed fan, Don.
Oh, thank you. That means so much. It really does.
You know, keep doing what you're doing.
Because, I will.
Because we Disney-files appreciate it. We really do.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm a fan of, you know, Disney historians. I'm a fan of yours and what you guys do and just keeping the history of films alive. And, you know, so a lot of it is, like I said earlier, I don't really think of myself as a particular I'm a film producer, yes, and an author, kind of, and all those things. But I'm kind of an intuitive person, and I guess I'm a storyteller. If you had to stop and say one thing, I love telling stories, especially stories that you haven't heard before.
Well, it's a good thing to be.
Yeah.
It's a good thing to be, and that's what's led me through my life.
Isn't it so interesting that the two extremes, one is the animation and the other is the documentary?
Yeah.
So you really do play in these two different worlds, one that is completely imagination and you can do whatever it is you want to do and make anything happen. And the other side, you know, you're talking about the AIDS crisis. It's quite different.
It is quite different.
You know, quite different situations. But it's life.
It's life, and I think it's refreshing for me to deal with documentaries because that's journalism.
Yes.
And yes. I'm fascinated with that, and I'm fascinated with how you can craft a story out of journalistic facts and make it plausible and yet make it entertaining or involving for the audience. And it's a great refreshment from having 600 people and $150 million to make an animated feature, which is luxury and wonderful, to having three people and $10 to make a documentary. And I love both of them equally. I really do.
Are you a social media person?
A little bit, yeah.
Where do people follow you then?
They can at Don Hahn on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook just as myself everywhere, Instagram. So, yeah, you can find me out there in the ethos. I have a donhahn.com website where you can find my paintings, because I paint, and a lot of the books and movies I've worked on and little interesting backstories about those things. So
great.
There.
Where else can they see him, Daddy, huh? Where else are they going to be able to see him?
Coming up shortly.
Coming up shortly, as in imminently, as in this weekend, you are kind enough to accept our invitation to be one of the authors who'll be signing books at Malton Fest.
I'm so flattered.
Oh, I'm so thrilled. Telling people about this makes me so happy, because not only anyone who comes is supporting authors, which obviously very near and dear to our hearts,
absolutely,
but also supporting a bookstore.
Yes.
Larry Edmonds is who is getting all the books for us, and Jeff runs it.
Larry Edmonds Bookshop is a Hollywood landmark itself.
It is.
And so to be able to do both of those things just makes me...
I'm really honored to do that for all those same reasons. Because I live up towards Pasadena, and I will spend weekends at Vroman's up there.
Oh, yeah. You know,
so. Vroman's one of the great bookstores left in America. That's right.
It is. So to be able to hang out with you guys and sign a few books is a treat.
I'm so excited.
It's a real treat.
Come for Mother's Day, my friends. There's nothing better than on Mother's Day sitting around.
If you haven't picked out a Mother's Day gift yet, think of coming to Malton Fest Sunday and getting a personally inscribed book for your mom.
Yes, and I will write anything in my book.
I will write whatever you want.
Yeah, within the laws of the state of California. Yes, but, right. Still.
Yeah. I'm glad that you clarified.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's very, that's how you know he is a producer.
Oh, yes.
He gets those little bitty,
that's right.
God forbid someone comes
Don,
in.
Thanks again for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks you guys for asking me.
And we will see you all next week. Malton on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan-owned entertainment company. They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.